From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion. This hour, the cosmos. I'm Jim Fleming. I have a simple question for you. How did the universe begin? For most of us, our answer falls into one of two categories, scientific or religious. For example, a strict interpretation of the Bible says God created the heavens and the earth in 6 days. Science, on the other hand, has the Big Bang theory. These two ideas are so at odds, so disparate, that any common ground seems, well, inconceivable. But is it?
Each of those two, science and religion, is one piece of the puzzle, and we should be humble enough to learn from both.
Science without religion is lame, but religion without science is blind.
Science is a human activity. Science belongs to all of us. No one should ever tell you otherwise, you know? Yeah.
What is God on the scale even of a galaxy? What is God on the scale of an atom?
Today, I am God.
This hour, we'll look at the cosmos through a different lens, not one of religion and not one of science. Instead, we'll use both lenses at the same time and hope to take you closer to the stars than you've ever been before. First, the view from the center of the universe. For millennia, humans put themselves in the center. Then, along came Copernicus, who shattered the idea of the Earth as the center of the universe. But what if everything actually did revolve around us? Physicist Joel Primack believes just that. He's written a book with Nancy Abrams called The View from the Center of the Universe, and they told Steve Paulson why humanity's moved back into the center.
We say they're central or special in a number of different ways. One is that we're made of the rarest stuff in the universe, heavy elements, the kind of atoms that are only created deep inside stars. Another is that we live at the center of time. We live at the center of the time of our planetary system. The Earth and the Sun were born about 4.5 billion years ago, and about 5 billion years in the future, the Sun is going to profoundly change. It will turn into a red giant star. It will swallow the inner planets, and it may burn Earth to a crisp.
Now, this perspective that you're critiquing, I mean, what I guess would commonly be called the Newtonian view of the universe, and what you have also called the existential view, that there really isn't any meaning, that really has been the dominant view among scientists for centuries, hasn't it? And many modern scientists, I mean, Carl Sagan and Stephen Jay Gould to Stephen Hawking today, I mean, they've basically said that humans really don't matter in the great scheme of things.
You know, if you take a Newtonian view of the universe as a whole, you really can't say anything else. And for several centuries, there hasn't been much of a choice. It's only in the last few years, the last decade or so, that there really has been a completely new and well-supported theory of the universe that gives us a completely different picture. So really, until now, the existential view was the only one that was really scientifically well-supported. The science, however, does not tell us what our centrality means. That is actually going beyond science.
So you're saying that, in a sense, we have to create our own myths to find meaning in the universe.
Well, we have a tremendous amount of scientific foundation now. Yes, we do need, you're absolutely right, we do need to create our own myths. But it is no longer possible to just create myths that we like or that feel good or that make us somehow feel connected to other people that share them. We're past that stage. The only myths that are feasible and going to be really satisfactory in the future are those that are based on this new picture of reality. We are now at a real turning point where we have the new scientific foundation, and now is the time to start constructing a mythology. You know, sometimes I hate to use the word mythology because people think of it as implicitly wrong, but a mythology is not something that's implicitly wrong. A mythology is a way of looking at reality that puts us into the story. That's all it is.
Well, you in your book, you recount the stories of various mythologies going back to the ancient Egyptians, and you make the point that that was profoundly important to the longevity of Egyptian society. I mean, this is a civilization that lasted 3,000 years, and you're really saying that it was partly because of their creation stories.
Oh, yes, because they grounded their civilization, they grounded their whole story of the gods and where they came from and everything in their understanding of the stars, which was, in fact, the most stable thing and remains the most stable thing for humans. Today, we have this tendency to ground our deepest beliefs in each other, which is very dangerous. We are not stable. We really need to ground ourselves in the earth and in the cosmos. And now that we understand the cosmos, it's possible to do that.
So you're saying that it's partly through the language of these stories that, I mean, that's what gave them power. I mean somehow they just,
yes,
they went from simple stories into something much larger, much more powerful, something mythic.
Yes, stories are how we understand everything. That's how human beings understand. I mean, it's hard to imagine understanding anything outside of a story.
So that's what you're trying to do here. You're trying to tell a story of the universe.
We are trying to tell the story of the universe. It's different. We are trying to make what science has discovered into an accurate but also resonant story.
Is this another way of talking about God?
Well, the conceptions that we have of God very much depend on who you're talking to and what that person's background is. If the concept of God expands with our conception of the universe, God has to describe and somehow account for everything in the universe, the smallest things and the biggest things, and maybe even eternal inflation. This certainly challenges earlier conceptions. Let me leave it like that.
Well, I have to ask you, do either of you believe in God?
You know, in our book, we weren't actually going to address this, and our editor said, you know, you're skittering around this question that everybody wants to know the answer to. Would you please just answer that very question? Do you believe in God? So what we said was, we believe in God as we understand God. And that's complicated. God, if it's going to be a meaningful concept, has to embrace the entire universe. There has to be some sort of concept of God on the scale of eternal inflation. What is God on the scale even of a galaxy? What is God on the scale of an atom or the nucleus of an atom? In other words, we have a real dearth of metaphors. We cannot describe God with human-type metaphors and think that we're describing anything worthy of being a God in this universe.
Einstein believed that the universe is, at some deep level, a fantastic intellectual conception. He also said that the most mysterious thing about the universe is that we can understand it, that there's some kind of connection between the way the human mind works and the deep underlying concepts that describe how the universe works. Einstein, like I think most successful physical scientists, had a profound belief that if we really try hard, we can understand this amazing universe. That's an article of faith. In fact, it's a very optimistic kind of faith that all successful scientists have to share. The scientists who aren't sufficiently optimistic, of course, aren't going to make the great discoveries.
Well, it seems to me you're fighting against the conventional view that science does not deal with meaning. Science, we all know, is wonderful at figuring out how the world works, but in terms of why anything matters, as I think most people assume, you have to go outside science to figure that out.
Indeed, you do. Science itself doesn't tell us what things mean. It doesn't put us into the picture as participants under most circumstances. On the other hand, if scientists who work on developing the modern picture of the universe or of life don't also try to explain how to think about it, and what it means to them at least, then who will? People who don't know as much, who haven't thought as hard. So I personally think that at least some scientists have to go public with their thoughts about the meaning of the scientific work that they're doing. Now, scientists are naturally very worried about this. Science has developed this wonderful ability to work across national boundaries without regard to religion or political ideology. And that's partly because we leave all those things behind when we just talk about science. And scientists are naturally worried that if we talk about meaning, and the implications of our scientific work, then it will call into question our objectivity and our ability to collaborate across national borders and such. But as I said, we do have a responsibility, we scientists, and if we don't talk about these things, who will?
You know, one way of seeing this whole project of yours to tell us that we are living in a meaningful universe is that you're just trying to make us feel good. And I'm guessing critics of yours might say that what you're trying to do is to create a new mythology out of the barest threads.
Well, the meaning is not there. Meaning is something that human beings create. What we're saying is that for the first time, we have a scientific foundation on which we can build a meaningful universe. From the time of Galileo 400 years ago, that was impossible. We simply could not have a universe that put us at the center. It didn't make any sense because the only way that we had to understand central was, is the Earth the center of the universe? And Galileo showed us, no, Earth is not the center of the universe. Therefore, we thought we cannot be central in any way. But now in modern cosmology, we have found out that we are central to the underlying physics and cosmology principles of this new universe. Now, if you're saying we're doing this to feel good, well, yeah, what's wrong with that? Why should we try to feel bad? The fact is that we need inspiration in this society more than we need food. We need it desperately.
Joel Premack and Nancy Abrams are the author of the book, The View from the Center of the Universe. Steve Paulson spoke with them. You're listening to the sound of Earth, recorded from space. The sounds are generated in the Van Allen radiation belt by electrons spiraling along Earth's magnetic field. They were recorded by Don Gurnett, who's been working with NASA, recording and studying audio from space for more than 40 years.
Well, most people think of space as a vacuum, but in fact, there's considerable gas pressure there, much lower than here in the atmosphere and the surface of the Earth. But nonetheless, there is a gas out there. And an astonishing variety of waves can propagate in this gas. And that's what I've spent a good part of my life studying with spacecraft that are, go out in space, and we can detect these waves.
Well, I'm curious. Let's hear an example. We have something that you've called a Jovian bow shock. What is this?
Well, the word bow shock really kind of comes from the idea of the bow wave of a ship. You know, when a ship is going through the water, it produces kind of a V-shaped wave. Now, to understand how these bow shocks occur in space, you first have to realize that there's a gas flowing out from the sun all the time. It's called the solar wind. In fact, it blows out from the sun by the Earth at nearly a million miles an hour. You usually don't know that down here in the surface of the Earth, but it's happening all the time. It produces effects on the Earth, for example, like the aurora. When this very high-speed wind runs into the magnetic field of, let's say, Jupiter or the Earth, it produces a shock wave out in front, just like when a supersonic airplane is going through the air. And this shock wave has a tremendous amount of turbulence in it and waves that we can detect with our instruments on the spacecraft. The recording we're going to play was made from Voyager 1 as it flew by Jupiter in 1979.
There's a physicality to it that I didn't, frankly, expect.
There is. You can talk about these shock waves using a textbook or something like that. And, you know, the reality really sinks in when you actually hear it, when you go through it. It's one thing to make plots of the velocity of the solar wind as you go through the shock. You can see the velocity decrease when you go through the shock wave. But I think these sounds just add a reality to it that you don't get any other way.
Yeah. Well, let's hear another one. The next one we have, you call a Jovian whistler, right?
Yes. Whistlers are a very special wave phenomena that occurs near a planet. It's produced by lightning. What happens is when there's a lightning stroke in this ionized gas, this plasma that surrounds the planet, the high frequencies travel much faster than the low frequencies. So after a lightning stroke, you'll hear the high frequencies first, followed by lower and lower frequencies. So you hear a sound we call a whistler, which sort of sounds like this. It goes... I'd like to have you think about it in the following way. If you sit in a very quiet room, you really don't expect the molecules up in a corner of the room to suddenly get together and whistle at you. But strangely enough, this happens in this ionized gas that we call a plasma out there. Now, we, in fact, detected many whistlers as we flew by Jupiter, and this was the first evidence that Jupiter had lightning. In fact, it was the discovery of the first planet in our solar system other than Earth that had lightning.
We've been talking about Jupiter all this time, but we should go on because the ships have gone on. You have emissions from Saturn, right?
Yes, we flew Voyager 1 and 2 by Saturn, and more recently we have the Cassini spacecraft in orbit around Saturn. And we have a especially good instrument on Cassini that can measure a very broad range of frequencies. And we, during the approach to Saturn, we recorded some really spectacular radio emissions from Saturn.
Do you consider these sounds music?
Yes, I guess that's my view. I've had some interesting discussions with some other musicians about this issue, like does music have to be produced by humans? But I've always thought they have a musical content.
Don Garnett is a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Iowa. The music you're listening to is an excerpt of Sun Rings, composed by Terry Riley and performed by the Kronos Quartet. The musical work was commissioned by NASA and includes the space sounds collected by Don Garnett. Want more sounds of space? Just go to our website at www.ttbook.org/god. And while you're there, send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Later this hour, Cosmic Africa.
Why is the sun going blind? The telescope is eating the sun. The ones who eat the sun live in the west. They change into lions. The owners of torment are coming.
I'm Jim Fleming. This hour is called The Cosmos. It's part of Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.
You never know those flying saucers that people are all seeing.
I really think there's something else out there. You mean other peoples? I do. Will we ever see them? I don't believe so.
I think that there is intelligent life out there, and we're probably the Alabama of the universe, and they just kind of avoid us.
That there might be other life forms out there. I just don't think they're as high-tech as the humankind. I think that they'd be more on the lines of a deer-like animal, nothing very civilized at all.
There's other beings. Yeah, I think it would be selfish of us to think that we are alone in this cosmos.
No, I don't. We seem like we have a lot of other things, extraterrestrial, extra-dimensional, extra-spiritual influences impinging on our life.
Who knows? Alien-human babies, you know, mixed race stuff. It would be cool.
understand for Catholic priests, we're not alone at all. We have, of course, the presence of God.
To answer your question, do I believe something else is out there? I really do believe, but the thing for us is to just learn how to get along with each other.
There must be other life in the universe. I have no question, I have no doubt. I know that it's there, and I hope we meet them.
Tebin Bedupe is an unlikely astrophysicist. He grew up under apartheid in a poor South African village about 4 hours north of Johannesburg. But his childhood love of the stars couldn't be suppressed. Today, Madupe is a researcher at the South African Astronomical Observatory, the continent's largest. Tebi Madupe is also the subject and producer of the documentary Cosmic Africa. In it, he gathers the astrological legends of the Bushmen of the Kalahari and the Dogon people in Mali. His goal for the film was to marry his science to his African spiritual roots. And Strange Champs asked Madupe how he came to love the stars.
We didn't have electricity, and so the stars were really brilliant at night, and there was no way you could ignore the presence of such beautiful stars, you know, with different colors, some red, some yellowish in color, others whitish, bluish in color. Mm. It was very, very beautiful.
Were the stars and planets a big part of your upbringing? I mean, did you grow up hearing stories about them?
Well, yeah, especially when I was much younger. I think up to the age of about 8 or 9, you know, we used to stay with my grandparents in our village, and every evening after dinner, we would sit around the fire and some people would go and sing and dance. And often also we would sit and listen to our grandparents telling us stories about the night sky.
What sort of stories did they tell?
For example, there was a story of how the different colors of the stars were formed. One time many years ago, when a girl saw her mother roasting roots on the fire, and she wanted to have the roots, although they were not ready yet, and she kept nagging her mother. And when her mother refused, you know, she was angry, and she picked up the burning roots and threw them up. And from the sparks and the different colors that come from the sparks when you throw the fire up came different colors of stars, you know.
Mm. How old were you when you fell in love with astronomy?
I was 13 years old. That's why I said 1986, when Halley's Comet visited our night sky in Southern Africa. Because of this, the newspapers and the radio talked a lot about the comet and also about astronomy. Our school, as a result, organized a theme week where all the subjects we did at school covered astronomy. And because of that, you know, I got inspired and I got curious to want to find more about astronomy. I went to our library, I read more about astronomy from astronomy books, and fortunately I came across a book on how to make a little telescope from material that you can easily find at home. I went to our school and I borrowed some lenses and I built myself a telescope at age 13. And with a telescope, I remember one chilly evening I pointed it to the moon and I was just captivated by the beauty of what I saw. I saw craters, I saw mountains and valleys on the moon with my little telescope that I built with my own hands. It was really, really special.
Tell me something about that journey you went on looking for, essentially, I guess, the ancient roots of African astronomy. You spent a bunch of months living with the Bushmen of the Kalahari Desert and also the Dogon people in Mali. What made you choose those particular people?
We selected those communities because they are living communities. We wanted our documentary to be a living documentary, which will show very clearly how traditional societies used to rely on stars for their day-to-day living. And the fascination with the Bushmen is that they are considered to be the world's oldest people. And therefore, the stories that we heard from them are some of the world's oldest stories. And really, it's beautiful. I mean, it connects us with our history very nicely.
Long, long ago, before stars and meteors, the Creator made the first fire. The Creator had two sons called Kanka and Koma. One day, Kanka and Koma went out hunting with a family of lions. But the treacherous lions ate the boys. In his anger and despair, the Creator made a fire. He put the fire into a meteor and disguised the meteor as eland horns. The Creator called the meteor down from the sky. The meteor killed the lions, So the Creator's heart was calmed, and there was fire for people on Earth. Today we still see Kanka and Koma as two stars in the sky. They tell us when the year ends and when the year begins. They tell us about the future, the rainy season, and the beginning of winter.
Had you heard that story before? Was it new to you?
No, it was quite new. I mean, the best part I remember about the Bushmen was how amazing and fantastic storytellers were. I mean, when I was sitting there in the evenings listening to these old men and watching how animated they were as they were telling the stories, I kept thinking of my two children at home, you know, of how much lucky they would be to grow up in an environment where every evening they were taught how to link up with nature, and also in a very beautifully visual way that we witnessed with the Bushmen.
Hmm. Tell me about the Dogon people. What did they teach you about their connection with the sky?
Oh, the Dogons were really amazing. One evening, I went out with the two old men to go and show me the different stars. And I asked one old man what was the most important star to his people. And he told me that the Pleiades, you know, those are the, some people call them seven sisters. It's a cluster of stars which are held together by gravity. So the Pleiades, according to this man, was the most important star to his people. And so just to check how much he knows about the Pleiades, I asked him to give him the times of the days and the different times in the year when the Pleiades can be seen, whether in the morning or in the evening. And the old man told me all of this. So I went to my laptop and checked, and I ran a software to check whether what he was telling me was true. And he was spot on. He was very, very correct, because indeed, I mean, he puts a lot of effort into studying the movement and positions of the stars.
The diviner builds his map with the symbols of the sun and moon. He shapes the constellations and the elements of the earth. He prays to the stars for guidance. Then he sprinkles ground nuts to lure the jackal to walk the map. During the night, the paw prints left on the map will give answers to the diviner's questions.
When you were spending time with the Bushmen and with the Dogon people, and you were asking for their stories about the stars and the planets and what they knew, did you ever in turn share your knowledge of the cosmos with them?
Well, we thought hard about that, but then we decided that to a large extent we wouldn't do it, because I went there primarily as a student to learn about their knowledge. And we didn't want to confuse them with the things that we know, and we certainly didn't want to impose our belief systems on theirs. So really, it was just purely us learning their system.
There is one moment of conflict between the traditional cosmologies and your Western scientific cosmology. There's a moment when you're watching a solar eclipse with the Bushmen, I think.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, tell me what happened.
Okay, so a couple of days before the eclipse, we asked them questions about eclipses. And from there, they told us that, you know, according to them, eclipses are bad things. They associate eclipses with evil spirits, especially with the lion being the most feared and hated animal among the Bushmen. So then when a couple of days later the eclipse happened, they started suspecting us, you know, how can normal human beings, according to them, be able to predict or know about the coming of an eclipse. And so because of that, they were not happy with us. They thought that we were bringing evil things, evil spirits to the village.
Nai is saying that it looks like something has broken the sun, like a piece is broken off. Why is the sun going blind? The telescope is eating the sun. The ones who eat the sun live in the West. They change into lions. The owners of torment are coming.
So what effect did it have on you to spend time with the Bushmen and with the Dogon people and to find these kind of deep roots to your own astronomy?
It was a very humbling experience. I mean, to know that the apartheid system and the colonialism system has try to hide away information that could be empowering to us, and that I've been lucky enough that I've had access to this information. And I was very, very much inspired to make sure that this information doesn't die with these communities, and that this information finds its ways in a form of a film, and also, secondly, in a form of books that would be easily accessible to our young people, so that they also rejoice in knowing that their ancestors, just like other people's ancestors, were very truly curious about the night sky, and they also had their own belief systems associated with stars and so on, just like everyone else on Earth.
So they can have a sense that astronomy, that studying the stars, studying the planets, is just as African as it is Western?
That's correct, yeah, yeah. I mean, to me, that is the biggest lesson I've obtained from this journey, was that truly science is a human activity. Science belongs to all of us. No one should ever tell you otherwise, you know. Yeah.
I'm climbing on a thread into the sky towards the moon. My path is filled with fire, bright and shining. I feel a wind on my face as I fly. It is a person's soul. This wind, that tense, that changes. The owners of torment are dangling in the sky, and I drive them back. My ancestors guide me well on the shining road. They take me back along the same road, so that I can enter my body and be well. And then I know I have spoken with God, and my heart is happy.
Tebe Madupe is a professor of ethno-astronomy at the University of Cape Town in South Africa. His documentary is called Cosmic Africa, and Strange Champ spoke with him. Want to read or hear more? Go to our website at ttbook.org/god. And while you're there, send us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Coming up later this hour, astrophysics and religion.
It's Christmas all the time in physics. We're discovering whole new universes just right next door. And this is what makes it so thrilling. If you are religious, what you're doing is unveiling the glory of God.
I'm Jim Fleming. This hour is called The Cosmos. It's part of Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion, brought to you by Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Daniel Matt is one of the foremost scholars on Jewish mysticism and the Kabbalah. One day, after a lecture, a student told him that it sounded a lot like the Big Bang Theory. Intrigued, he started doing some research in astrophysics and cosmology, and he was shocked at what he found. Daniel Matt's the author of God and the Big Bang. He told Steve Paulson that the Big Bang Theory is the creation myth of science.
The Big Bang is technically a theory, but a well-supported theory. On the other hand, when I say myth, I don't mean something that's not true. By myth, I really mean a narrative that makes sense of our life, a narrative that we tell and retell in order to find our place in the universe. So I think a myth could be, you know, factually accurate or inaccurate. In this case, I think the Big Bang, you know, may be the first accurate creation story that we've ever had.
Well, I have to say, to me at least, the Big Bang defies common sense. I mean, the idea that that all the matter and energy that's now in the universe was at one point somehow or at one time compressed into a tiny point that was far smaller than a single proton. I mean, it's just It's hard to imagine this point of almost infinite density. And I mean, it's almost a leap of faith, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly, you know, it certainly boggles the mind. And, you know, as a number of physicists have said, if you think you understand this, or if you think you understand quantum mechanics, then you haven't gotten it. So it's almost something that's meant to confuse you or to startle you. And that, in a sense, is, you know, one of the parallels between cosmology and mysticism. Because mysticism is also often counterintuitive, and mysticism claims that the boundaries that we usually accept between things aren't final, aren't absolute. So that the notion of a mystical oneness is as mind-boggling as this scientific oneness. You know, you could say that the basic claim of mysticism, that all is one, that is also in some ways a scientific fact, by which I mean, you know, we're made of the same stuff as all of creation. So everything in the universe is composed, or everything in the world we know at least, is composed of the same primordial elements, that interplay of matter and energy. So in that sense, there's a oneness you can speak about in scientific terms and a oneness you can speak about in mystical terms. Both of them are mind-boggling, but scientists would say, and mystics, I think, would agree, that you shouldn't be fooled by the outer surface appearance. It seems that things are separate. It seems that there are sharp boundaries between water and rocks. But really, all things in the world, certainly all material objects, if you analyze them, if you break them down, they're composed of the same primordial elements.
Now, we've been talking about the Big Bang, and it's worth pointing out that the Big Bang doesn't actually explain the very first moment of creation. I mean, as far as scientists can determine, it only explains what happened after something like 1/1,000,000th of the first second after the absolute beginning.
Right. I think technically it's 10 to the minus 43 second after the beginning. So it's a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, something like that. So an accurate cosmologist would say that we don't know what preceded the Big Bang. The Big Bang is not the ultimate beginning. The Big Bang is as far back as we can trace right now. And I think what's refreshing about most scientists is that they're willing to admit what they don't know. And I think that's something that, you know, we have to learn from science, to strive to understand as much as we can and to admit when we don't know, not to claim that we know everything. Sometimes people in the religious camp, you know, want a finality or an absolute knowledge. And a scientist sometimes can be more humble than that. But there still is room for mystery in science, at least for the unknown. There's a respect for the unknown.
Also, there's some profound philosophical questions. Was the Big Bang an event without a cause? And I don't know if that's a scientific mm-hmm. question or if that's a metaphysical question.
Yeah, there are cosmologists who claim that, you know, many cosmologists, or most cosmologists claim that you don't need someone or something to start it off. It's something that emerged out of the vacuum. This notion of a vacuum is very striking, an interesting parallel between science and mysticism there too, because the vacuum that cosmologists speak about is not entirely empty. You could say it's a vacuum that is filled with potential. It's pregnant with potential. One of the most attractive paradoxes in my mind in all of mysticism is referring to God as nothing or no thing. I think it is better to pronounce it, in this case, no thingness. God, you might say, is the energy that animates all things, but God is not to be identified with any one object or thing.
Now, we've been talking about science and particularly the cosmology of the Big Bang, and I know there are a lot of religiously minded people who are really looking into quantum physics and seem to find solace or some very exciting possibilities there when the uncertainty principle in quantum physics, mm-hmm. that it's impossible to determine the precise location and velocity of subatomic particles. I mean, all we can talk about is probability. Do you find these to be of spiritual importance, these insights of quantum physics?
Certainly so. A quantum physicist would say, you know, don't be fooled by the outer layer of things. This table seems solid, but underneath, there's a teeming cascade of energy. There's energy circulating constantly in what we call solid matter. So the fact that solid matter is composed of energy, I think that gives us a way to understand the relationship between God and the world. God is also animating all of existence. So it's really a way to reimagine God as that which animates all of existence.
Do you think human beings need myths to live by? I mean, is this where we get our sense of purpose, and not to mention our stories of creation? Are those essentially mythic stories?
I think we need some way to make sense of the universe, you know, some way to wrap our mind around the universe. And telling a story about how the world began is one of the oldest ways to do this. You know, telling a story about how we came to be and what our purpose is here, it's very hard for people to live without meaning. Now, that meaning doesn't have to be something imposed from the outside. It can be something that you create. As an existentialist, you know, would say, you create your own meaning. But without some meaningfulness, without some purpose and goal, it's very hard to maintain one's equilibrium or one's sanity.
Can science itself give us those myths, give us the meaning?
I'm not sure science can give the meaning, but I think we can learn from science and religion both. In other words, my attitude is that each of those two, science and religion, is one piece of the puzzle, and we should be humble enough to learn from both. You know, many people plant themselves in one camp, claiming, you know, I'm rational or I'm a believer, and they feel threatened or they feel opposed to the other approach. A true believer who doesn't want to be bothered with the theory of evolution, or a totally rational scientist who thinks that religion is total superstition. Those are the extremes. And you find people in those extremes or somewhere near those extremes. But I think the point is that these are two strategies that humanity has created, the scientific approach and the religious approach, and we should respect the two. I'm not saying the two should be fully equated. I don't think they should. I think that's far too simplistic an approach. But I think we can learn from both of them and enrich ourselves by understanding the insights that each has to offer.
Daniel Matt is the author of God and the Big Bang, Discovering Harmony Between Science and Spirituality. Steve Paulson spoke with him. Theoretical physicist Michio Kaku keeps some pretty wild ideas in his head. As a scholar of quantum physics, he believes an electron can be in two places at the same time. As the co-creator of string field theory, he believes the secrets of the universe are explained through an 11-dimensional world of vibrating strings. But Michio Kaku says that's easy to understand. Try wrapping your head around religion.
Well, I grew up with two mutually exclusive ideas in my brain. My parents are Buddhists, and in Buddhism, there is no beginning. There is no end. There's only timeless nirvana. And the golden life is to reach this high state of consciousness called nirvana. But as a child, I was sent to Sunday school, and I learned about all the great stories of the Bible. I learned about the ark, the whale, the burning bush, and I also learned about Genesis. And so I had these two mutually exclusive ideas in my head, which until very recently could not be resolved. Now, for the first time, I think, in millennia, we can resolve these two contradictory paradigms.
I don't understand quite how this is possible, because as far as I know, there is no place for Genesis in nirvana.
That's right. So how do you reconcile a beginning of a universe with a religion, Buddhism, where there is no beginning? The way to reconcile it is with modern physics. The latest theory is called the multiverse, in which case our universe is a soap bubble of some sort, expanding soap bubble, in an ocean of other soap bubbles. And these soap bubbles pop into existence, expand rapidly, some of them contract, our universe is continuing to expand. And so Genesis takes place all the time in an ocean of nirvana. And to me, this melds the two paradigms together.
Well, but what does this... I'm sorry, I keep thinking about what this means in terms of human understanding, and I think that may be the point at which religion really comes into it, because we have all been looking for a purpose, for a source, for an explanation, whatever those may be. If you accept one of the traditional religions, Christianity, for instance, the possibility of multiple universes in which Jesus Christ exists multiple times seems to be in conflict.
Well, in 1600, Giordano Bruno was burned alive in the streets of Rome because he said that there are other planets out there with other stars and life on them, and the church did not like that idea at all. Because can you imagine a billion popes in outer space? Can you imagine a trillion saints? Can you imagine a quadrillion doctrines and papal encyclicals and dogmas? Rather than entertain a billion Jesus Christ, they simply burned Giordano Bruno alive. Well, today, he has his revenge every 2 weeks. Every 2 weeks, a new planet is discovered orbiting another star system just the way Giordano Bruno had predicted in 1600. Now, we don't see evidence of life, but we do see evidence of extrasolar multiple Earths out there. Now we're talking about multiple universes. To be fair, most of them are dead. Most of them have no life on them. But some of these soap bubbles have atoms, and they have DNA, and perhaps they have life.
How new is this? You look at the great minds, the great names, at least, of history in physics. Einstein would seem to be the poster boy for physics and, therefore, for competition between physics and religion. But, in fact, he believed that in the end he was searching for physics. What did he say? He was actually searching for the mind of God?
That's right. He wanted an equation 1 inch long which would allow him to read the mind of God. Einstein once said that science without religion is lame, but religion without science is blind. And so he believed in two gods, not one God, but two kinds of gods. The first God is the God of prayer, the God of intervention, the God that parts the waters, the God that helps the sick and smites the Philistines. That's the God that he felt uncomfortable with, the personal God, the God of intervention. He believed in the God of Spinoza, the God of Leibniz, the God of reason, the God of order, the God of harmony. And he believed that the laws of the universe were so simple, so elegant, and it didn't have to be that way, that there must have been a designer to design the laws, not to design people, we're not talking creationism, but to design the physical laws. God is the lawgiver. The ultimate laws are the laws of physics. So who gives you the laws of physics? Einstein called him the old one. It's been since translated as the old man, but that's sexist. In the original German, it's the old one. And I think there's a lot of resonance to that. I think a lot of physicists feel comfortable with that point of view, that there is a lawgiver. There are the fundamental laws, which are simple, beautiful, and it didn't have to be that way. The universe could have been chaotic. The universe could have been random. The universe could have been a bunch of electrons, mist, a bunch of neutrinos that never go anywhere. Instead, we have DNA. We have life, we have stars, galaxies. And so he believed that there was a God, but not the God of intervention. The God of harmony is the God that Einstein believed in.
How important is this to you as a physicist, to any physicist, in fact? Does it matter whether you believe in God? Because the laws will remain the same, presumably, whether you do or not. And your pursuit of answers can remain as vigorous whether you believe ultimately in a God.
Well, it does and it doesn't. In my research, for example, when I get up in the morning, I try to follow in the footsteps of my hero, Einstein. When Einstein woke up in the morning, he would say, "Today, I am God. I'm going to create a universe today. How would I create the universe that I see around us? What is the minimal set of laws necessary to create a star? The suns, the galaxies. E equals mc squared, for example, is 1 inch long. But that's a secret of the sun. That's why the stars shine. M turns into E. And that's why we have E equals mc squared. And that's why we have the Earth. The Earth is a spin-off from the sun, and the sun gets its energy from E equals mc squared. So I try to do this. It's difficult, but I say to myself in the morning, okay, today I'm God. How would I create, through Genesis, a world with stable matter, with all the elements and the forces we see around us. And that's what I do. I'm trying to finish that theory. I want that one-inch equation that would allow us to read God's thoughts. That's what Einstein's dream was.
What happens when you have a discussion like this with a community that wants very badly to believe in the straight story that they've been told all their lives?
Well, if you take a look at the religious books of the world, I think most historians will call them allegorical. Many of the chapters of the learned books are self-contradictory, in fact. If you think that a holy book is, in fact, literal, you have the problem that even inside that book, you have contradictions. And so I think most historians would call them allegorical. And it's a question of ethics, too. When Galileo was put up by the Catholic Church and almost burned at the stake, one bishop said, the purpose of the church is not to determine how the heavens go, but to determine how to go to heaven. In other words, ethics.
But it's very reasonable when you say this, and you seem able to merge these two ideas clearly, perhaps because you started with your parents' notion of nirvana while learning about Genesis. Surely when you face critics of science and evolution in the schools, for instance, you don't get quite such reasonable responses?
Well, I tried not to insult people because instead of an arrogant scientist looking down on people, patronizing them and saying you're stupid because you don't believe in Darwinian evolution, we have to realize where people are coming from, you know? I mean, people are raised in a certain tradition that goes back many, many generations, and I think we should treasure that. I think we should respect people's upbringings, but we should also realize that there are many holy books. They all contradict each other. There are no two holy books that agree with each other. Science, however, does have a holy book, and that is Mother Nature. And so we get our clues from Mother Nature. So if you are religious and a scientist, how you would resolve it is very simple. Mother Nature is God's greatest creation. The greatest creation of God is Mother Nature herself. And if you want to honor God, then the way to honor God is to try to understand the secrets of his greatest creation, Mother Nature.
Michio Kaku is the author of Parallel Worlds, The Science of Alternative Universes and Our Future in the Cosmos. I'm Jim Fleming. This hour is called The Cosmos. It's part of Electrons to Enlightenment, a special series on science and religion. This series was produced by To the Best of Our Knowledge at the studios of Wisconsin Public Radio. For more information on To the Best of Our Knowledge or this series, please go to our website at www.ttbook.org/God.
PRI, Public Radio International.